This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Is this a problem?
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. All right, good. Now that we pulled the Monty Python on that one.
Now, here's your host.
Hello, this is your host, Janie Skull of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Abby Wambach of the Education Reform Movement, Daniela Fairchild.
I really like that one. I like that one.
Go!
So we used to listen to Portuguese radio when we wanted to listen to soccer games, and all we could hear was goal. We'd be like, with all these things that we don't understand, goal!
That's all important. That's all you need to know. So for those of you who are wondering who Abby Wambach is, she is, of course, the kicker from this weekend's big U.S. World Cup game against Brazil. We won in the penalty kicks, you know, after two overtimes, so it was a pretty big deal. I mean, were you watching it, Janelle? Did you see it?
No.
Oh, well, I saw the actual game part. I gave up around the, the 90th minute because I was like, there's no way Yusuf's coming back. We're down a person. We got a red card early in the game.
So you know what else is going on now in the soccer world? Is the 2011 Robot World Cup.
Is that in the soccer world?
Sure.
Is it robots playing soccer?
Yeah. Britain just got knocked out.
Why?
Because why not? Because robots are great.
They're not better than watching people play soccer. Who wants to watch robots play soccer?
Enough people to have built and televised the Robot World Cup.
This is an entire world that is functioning for no use. No use. But let's talk about the world that is functioning of use, if that's a phrase. With this week's Part in the Gadfly. Josh, what's our first question?
All right. Thank you, Janie. Paul Toff has been getting some flack from some in the education reform world for his recent New York Times Magazine article on no excuses in school cultures. Which is more important, student gains or overall achievement?
So basically, Paul Toff had an article this weekend that looked at student achievement and how reformers will really laud small achievements that are big, you know, on a relative scale. So if a school went from 12% proficiency to 24% proficiency, you know, it doubled its proficiency rate, but at the same time, it's still very low. And Paul Toff is arguing that, you know, it's not really fair for reformers to really say this is a great achievement if reformers are going to hold themselves to this no excuses mindset, because 24% proficiency is pretty poor, you know, overall, grand scheme of things, not really something, you know, we should really be patting ourselves on the back for. You know, I think he definitely has a very valid point. If the reform movement is really going to adhere to a no excuses mentality, you know, the kind of mentality that drives KIPP schools and really, you know, really academically strong, driven charter schools and, you know, school turnarounds and things like that, it's not really fair to say, okay, we can really rest on our laurels 24%. You know, we really need to keep going. What's your take, Daniela?
I think the big issue here isn't the question of student achievement versus student gains, but the question is that reformers, it should be happy with large student gains, but they absolutely shouldn't think that that's okay. You know, we should say, you know, we're making this improvement, that's fantastic, but there's still a long road to go. And in the reform world, we're very quick to make claims that we've succeeded or to hold up small successes as being, you know, this proof that the reform movement is successful. And I think we need to accept that it's going to take a long time to fix schools. And if we allow the reform movement to not, you know, if we don't expect to get gold stars all the time and we just expect to trot along, we're going to make great gains. But in not being able to accept that, not being able to admit that, you know, we're not where we want to be. And a lot of the reforms that we've tried, a lot of the initiatives that we've undertaken haven't seen these huge leaps and bounds. If we're okay to accept that, but say, you know, yeah, we do have these gains, we're definitely not where we want to be, but we're still working on it. If we're okay with that, then, you know, I think that's where we want to be. But in, you know, this, the issue of we either need to say we are no excuses culture or we're, you know, pandering to our own interest groups and we're, you know, trying to pull ourselves up higher than we are. I think that divisive mentality isn't where we want to be and isn't really a smart conversation to be having.
So, but is it disingenuous on any level to kind of say that these really small improvements are a good thing? Because in some ways, you know, they're not. Of course, we have to get, you know, we have to progress. We have to say, you know, we're not going to get to 100% proficiency in 1 year. But is it okay to say, you know, next year we're going to aim for, you know, 25% proficiency rather than saying next year we're going to aim for 100% proficiency?
I think that that's being honest. I mean, there are groups, and until we figure out how to scale, you know, a KIPP or how to scale some of these really strong high flyers, we do need to accept the fact that we're going to be trotting and we're going to be just plodding along. And if we say, you know, we're looking at No Child Left Behind and this achievement 100%, this cliff that's hitting us in 2014, and this is because we had decided, you know, we need 100% proficiency by 2014. That was a really ambitious goal, a great goal to have, but a really ambitious.
No excuses. We're going to get to that 100% proficiency.
Okay, so then we're saying reform has failed and just what, pack our bags and go home?
But should,
what's the alternative there?
Should we have said we're going to get to 40% proficiency by 2010 or 2014? You know, are we going to get to 80% proficiency?
Yes. 80%, that's what I want.
I like it. All right, Josh, next question.
The LA Times ran a story this week about how top teachers prepare their students to take state tests. What were the takeaways from this article?
So I thought this was a really interesting article. It highlighted a bunch of Hobart students, or Hobart teachers, rather. And for people who haven't read a Raffae Esquith book, he was the Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire guy. He was featured in the article as well. But so a lot of pretty strong teachers from a really high-performing elementary school in LA, as well as a handful of others that the LA Times had picked out from their own value-added metric, their own teacher quality metric, as being really successful, and, you know, interviewed them all and said, how are you guys handling teaching standard, teaching to the standards, and then thus teaching to the tests? And I thought it was really interesting that a lot of the teachers weren't coming in, these high quality teachers weren't coming in and saying, oh, well, we're, you know, into the workbooks more, and we're, you know, finding that we really need to focus on multiple choice practice more and things like that. But they were saying we're finding creative solutions to teach to these standards. We're finding creative solutions to make sure that our students are preparing themselves for that, are being prepared for the tests, because we found that when we just taught via workbooks and things like that, the kids weren't actually engaged. They weren't learning. They weren't actually being prepared for tests. So this whole idea, this whole notion of, you know, rote memorization, teach to test, seems to, by these few anecdotal little stories, isn't actually the best way to get students prepped for these tests.
But I would say that, you know, reading through the article, it does seem that these teachers certainly hold a little bit of bitterness, you know, against the whole testing culture. And yes, they're changing the curriculum and they're revamping how they present material, but at the same time, they don't like it. They don't like that they have to follow the state standards that mandate, here's the schedule of things that you're going to teach, here's the order in which, you know, here are the grades you're going to teach them in. It seems like they're definitely a little bitter about having that much autonomy restricted. And, you know, we were talking earlier, and I know, Daniela, you had said that, you know, that's kind of what standards are for, that standards are to lay out, here's the content that you need in all these grades so that you don't overlap. But on some level, you know, there definitely is the element of, if a teacher is passionate about a subject and it's not supposed to be taught in that grade, you know, I would still want my child's teacher to teach it if it's something that's really going to engage the kids. You know, if these are teachers that are going to be able to bring in all these different, you know, different ways to teach things and different projects and have a really good idea about a specific element of, you know, a child's curriculum, I would like them to have the leeway to be able to put that into the curriculum.
I'd also want my teacher teaching my child to be passionate about everything that he or she is teaching. So if I'm really passionate about the civil rights movement, I shouldn't be teaching first grade math. Shouldn't be doing it. I should be teaching, you know, high school level AP US history or something. That's what I should be doing. So if I'm passionate about my subject, I should be teaching that subject. And I would hope that the teachers find themselves in the right grade in class for that. And, you know, you can get into other issues on teachers being placed in classrooms that they shouldn't be in. That's a whole different debate for a different time. But I think that, you know, standards do exist for a reason. And I know this is against our sort of autonomy thing at Fordham, but I don't want teachers to just go willy-nilly teaching whatever they feel like on any given day. I want my kids to learn things. And if we're not holding teachers accountable on some level to these standards, how are we at all going to be sure?
Josh, question number 3.
Indiana no longer requires its students to learn cursive handwriting. Is this a problem?
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. All right, good. Now that we've settled that. Now that we pulled the Monty Python on that one.
No. I mean, I will admit, a lot of this comes from my own personal experience of growing up at a school that did not require cursive, I went from fifth grade to sixth grade into a school that suddenly did require cursive. And I, for the life of me, could not figure out why I needed to learn this skill. And I threw a fit, essentially, talked to my teachers. The only thing that they could come up with was that I needed to learn up, to, I needed to grow, sorry, I needed to learn cursive so that I could grow up and be able to sign a check. That was the entire rationale. I mean, I feel like in this day and age, first of all, we're typing so much that handwriting is important, but why do we need two different types of to learn, you know, if we can just learn regular handwriting, why do we need to learn cursive handwriting? They're just, to me, it's a very aesthetic quality of handwriting. It's not a necessary attribute of handwriting. And if you can write print and everyone can read it, why do you need cursive?
I guess I have two stories behind this. One, when I was teaching, I had one student, I had a lot of students who couldn't read and a lot of students who couldn't do a lot of things, had been failed a lot. But one of my students in particular came up to me one day very sheepishly and was like, you know, Miss D, can, that's what they called me, but, you know, can you teach me cursive? And he felt really bad about himself for not having learned that skill. That was a skill that adults that he knew. And maybe it's not something that he would use on a daily basis, but it gave him a sense of ownership over him, his learning, a sense of, you know, pride in knowing that.
Here's my issue, though, that I think there's two different, and this needs to be teased out. There is teaching children cursive so that they can read cursive, and if need be, they can write it. You know, they can actually spell out the letters. They know what each individual letter is in cursive. I do think that's necessary because there are things written in cursive, and they need to be able to learn how to read that.
Way to change your tone.
But the actual functionality of writing cursive and requiring students to write it for all of their materials and, you know, forcing children to write essays in cursive, that to me is just way beyond what we need to do. It needs to be functional. It does not need to be your mode of writing.
Okay, I will give you that. And I think that you and I are on the same page there. Okay. I also don't want my students in this day and age, I don't want students to pass in print paragraphs and print essays when they, you know, do take home reports and things
Why
like
not?
That because people have computers in schools.
Okay, I thought you meant as opposed to cursive.
You don't write handwritten things anymore. You're not going to put a resume in, you're not going to put a job application in handwritten, you're going to do that print, you know, typed out.
Yeah, even so, you know, writing essay tests now, are a lot of them are computer based,
right? So I think I agree with you there, but I think just as a skill, it's a worthwhile thing to know. It gives, you know, it gives a sense of pride. It gives a sense of adulthood. And I think that's, you know, on a, even just on an emotional level, is something that is worthwhile.
I want to be forever young, Danielle. I don't want to enter adulthood of cursing. All right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Josh, for helping us out with Pardon the Gadfly. Up next is Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome to Research Minute.
Thank you so much. Always lovely to be with the ladies.
It's always a fun week when, you know, the cats are away and the mice play. The mouse is playing. It's been a long week, folks. A long week.
People can't see me, but I'm just shaking my head here.
All right.
She's actually crying in the fetal position under the table, but it's okay. We'll keep going. So, Amber, what have you got for us this week?
This week, we don't talk a lot about, you know, early preschool and little kids, but this week we had a really neat study. It's out by researchers at NYU. They examined poor children's home learning environments to determine what role that these environments might play in getting them ready for school. So, in other words, we're talking about the school readiness gap as opposed to the achievement gap here, which doesn't get quite as much attention, but obviously, they're both related. Let me cut to the chase. Analysts studied roughly 1,800 children whose families fell below the poverty level and who had participated in an early Head Start evaluation. For each family, they collected data when the child was 1, 2, 3, and 5, just before they started kindergarten. So this is kind of unusual in terms of the longitudinal nature. They included data sources were parent interviews, assessment of the child's language and cognitive abilities, a video of the mother and child at play, and an inventory of the home environment. So things like, you know, are there books available for the kids? Analysts found many differences in terms of the home environments within the sample and divided the kids into 6 groups based on these characteristics. The big finding, roughly 70% of students who had positive home learning environments performed at or above national norms on tests of early school readiness. Kids with poor home environments scored as much as 20 points lower on these tests. More bad news, there was no group of children that started out with a poor home environment then saw those settings improve by the time they entered kindergarten, which could mean that some kids are already at risk of falling behind their similar peers at 15 months old, which is sort of sobering. Last little finding I'll highlight, the timing of the environment mattered in terms of the kids obtaining specific skills. So for instance, if your kid has a rich home environment at around 1 year old, they could better identify pictures. So they gave them, you know, different skills. So all in all, it just reiterates the importance of early intervention, what I would say.
Well, I guess my question then would be, what were the, did they measure early interventions? I mean, what was the result of adding Head Start into that mix? All of those students you said,
yeah, so they had, so about half of them, so the Head Start evaluation was different, but they'd been randomly assigned to the Head Start. Some received services and some didn't. This wasn't the Head Start evaluation, obviously, they pulled on the same pool of participants there. So, yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting to me is you rarely see this type of study where researchers are literally going into a home and taking inventory of what the home learning environment looks like, videotaping, you know, the parent. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a big danger here that the data could be skewed. I mean, when you ask a mom, do you read your kid? You know, how many moms are going to say no? You know, and I mean, a lot of it, you got some, you know, self reporting bias, I would imagine, going on in the survey. And, you know, if a parent knows there's a video on, I'm sure they're going to try to play differently with their child.
So my question, did they look at the different interventions and weight the different interventions to see if having books in the home led to more readiness than
it was kind of a weird thing where they say, you know, as you get older, the parent should have more books, which was another kind of weird thing. Like, you know, when you're one, we want 10 books. When you're two, we'd like to see 20. I don't know. I have a lot of reservations about the assumptions that went into how they defined the groups. But at the same time, I think, you know, this is kind of a neat study in terms of the data that they did collect. You know, it's probably a methodologist could get in here and blow holes in it this way and that. But at the same time, I think these are the right indicators. Maybe they aren't measured or quantified in the precise way that everybody would want. But obviously, if you have 15 books and they're all, you know, make spot run and they're in fifth grade, that's not any better than having one book that's To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, that you're trying to get the kid to read, you know, at a young age. So, I mean, the type of books, I mean, that kind of stuff is not what I saw them take into consideration. They just did a gross count of the number of books.
Yeah, I also wonder what the differing effects would be between having, you know, just strictly having books or something like that and kind of parental actions. I mean, if a one-year-old has books lying around, that's not going to be much help unless a parent actually is, you know, reading to them and is actually trying to do things to really stimulate, you know, their reading ability. So I don't know if there would be a way to tease that out or if this report did it at all. But it seems to me that would be a large, you know, component of it. And in trying to, like, intervene in these students' lives to ensure that, you know, all of them can actually perform at these high levels, what actual actions do we need to do?
Yeah, and I think they talked a little bit about how some parents play with their kids much more effectively than others in terms of pushing them, like, here's a dog. What does a dog say? You know, where other parents don't do that sort of follow-up. So they did actually analyze the videos and sort of say, you know what, some parents engage in play with kids much more effectively. And as the kids get older, those parents aren't as savvy about how to engage those kids in play, which makes sense. As your child starts learning, maybe you just don't have, especially if you're poor and you didn't have those types of activities growing up yourself, maybe you don't know how to sort of convey those things and teach those things to your kids. So it was just a neat study in terms of some of those data.
So what is our song that we have this week for these little kids?
So since we're talking about the importance of home and family, we have We Are Family by Sister Sledge.
Well done.
Are you old enough? You're not my senior here.
Of course I am. Don't you forget that.
Just because you sound like Kathleen Turner does not mean you are years my senior. Yes. We all love a good Sister Sledge. We are family. Up next, we have Chris Tessoni with his Dollars and Cents. This
is Dollars and Cents, where we
make sense
of education finance.
California has a great new plan to improve education in the state. Reduce state aid to schools by several billion dollars, shorten the school year by as many as 12 days, and ban teacher layoffs. Sound a little off? These ideas are all part of the legislature's recent attempts to pass a balanced budget in a tough fiscal environment. The Golden State already has a very expensive and mostly ineffective class size reduction program in place. So the new ban on layoffs just further ties superintendents' hands, giving them more rules for how to spend fewer state dollars. The state Senate's President Pro Tem, a Democrat, claims the law actually gives districts more flexibility by requiring them not to fire anyone. Don't think about that too hard or your head will hurt. At least mine did. EdTrust West's Arun Ramanathan has this one pegged, though. He told the Tribune in San Luis Obispo, the state has alerted school districts that they are job agencies, not educational agencies. I can only hope that the California legislature and Governor Jerry Brown suffer some sleepless nights this school year. They could have helped schools cope with less state aid by freeing them of mandates like class size reduction that don't work and waste money. Instead, they put union jobs ahead of the well-being of students.
So how in any way is banning layoffs related to getting a budget back in order? That just seems completely backwards to me. It seems to me you would want to say, we need at least 20%, you know, that I don't even understand how that's related to a budget bill.
It's insane. Well, I mean, like in a lot of other states, budget season is the season to cram a lot of policy priorities through. And so it seems to have been essentially a giveaway to the teacher unions and other special interests in Sacramento who said, we want this policy priority through. We know that essentially state aid was going to be reduced, so the unions were aware that layoffs would come down the pike. So this was just thrown in to try to tie superintendents' hands from doing what they need to do to get their budgets in place.
So, I mean, did they make any concessions for this? It just seems like there isn't a flip side to it, you know?
No, there's no concession. Essentially, it says whatever your staffing levels were, they need to stay there.
Wow.
I guess my question is, when do you think this is going to come back to bite California? I mean, not just this, but California's blatant lack of respect for financial realities.
They're arguably one of the, you know, in the worst shape of any country in the U.S. I mean, they're in terrible shape right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a story across the board in California when it comes to policies of just about every type. Everyone in the state wants to have their cake and eat it, too. This happens with their referendum process. You know, voters will essentially restrict tax revenues. You know, taxes can't be raised above a certain level for property taxes or other kinds of taxes. And yet, they also mandate tons and tons of spending through that process. So when the chickens will come to roost in terms of financial realities, who knows? It's definitely going to be interesting to watch what happens with district budgets over the next year. As superintendents struggle to make sense of this, but it's clear that the effects are going to be felt by kids right away. They're going to have to do contortions of some kind to get their budgets to balance, and it's just going to hurt kids. They've already mandated 7 days fewer of school days for districts that are strapped, and they've allowed another 5 days that could be cut from the school year if certain tax revenues don't come in, so it's going to hurt kids no matter what happens.
So I wonder then if, you know, California's got a decent charter legislation. California's got a decent charter, you know, set of charter bills going, and I wonder if, you know, we're just going to see a huge, you know, mass exodus from the public school system. If it's just going to be parents saying this is insane and trying to, you know, hit parent trigger type legislation, and like, how is that going to play in and just like leaving the traditional district
charter schools in California are cash strapped as well, though. I mean, there are a number of things about the charter sector in California that are attractive, but money ain't one of them. So you see innovative groups like Rocket Ship that are doing the best that they can with the resources that they have, but I don't know that the charter sector is going to be able to step up with a lot of really great new schools to serve these kids because they are being hit with the same resource problems.
It will be interesting to see what the backlash is, though. You know, I just thinking back to Hawaii a couple years ago when they had, you know, they had the series, I think it was 17 furlough days, which, you know, is somewhat equatable to having, you know, a week of school slash and then an additional 5 days. And that was a big deal. And eventually it was turned over. But, you know, it wasn't through a legislative process. So, you know, I hope that Californians see this and think this is crazy. I mean, obviously, anyone running an organization should have the ability to choose who's in that organization and who can be let go during, you know, a time of extreme need.
Right. Well, parents in California absolutely should get angry about this, and hopefully some change can come from that.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris, for coming on for Dollars and Cents. I guess that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to edexcellence.net and sign up to receive the original Education Gadfly in your inbox. Till next week.
I'm Danielle Fairchild.
And I'm Janie Scull of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.